Continuing. Barbie greeted his colleague, as Mingoya remembers it. "Hello, comrade. What do I hear? Are you working for a new employer?" Mingoya answered with surprise. "For what? For who, then?" Barbie, "Nah, for Mr. Ward, for example." Mingoya feared reproach. "Yes, doesn't the organization allow that?" Barbie laughed. "It's okay. There has to be cooperation," unquote. Let me read that again. Barbie greeted his colleague as Mingoya remembers it. "Hello, comrade. What do I hear? Are you working for a new employer?" Mingoya answered with surprise. "For what? For who, then?" Barbie, "Nah, for Mr. Ward, for example." Mingoya feared reproach. "Yes, doesn't the organization allow that?" Barbie laughed. "It's okay. There has to be cooperation." Mingoya says that it was first clear to him on that day that Barbie had become a top man for the CIA, because only top people knew the names of the other agency employees. The Moon Man Tom Ward was Klaus Barbie's CIA contact. The Moon Man Tom Ward was Klaus Barbie's CIA contact man only preceding and directly after the putsch of 1980. Reading that last sentence one more time, because a very, very short sentence, a very, very big meaning. The Moon Man Tom Ward was Klaus Barbie's CIA contact man only preceding and directly after the putsch of 1980. Barbie's steady CIA contact person was the munitions dealer Fernando Incauste. He boasted that he had direct contact with President Reagan, whom he allegedly knew during the latter's California governor days. Another one of Barbie's steady CIA contact people was Jorge Portugal, also a munitions dealer. He was Incauste's close co-worker and Barbie's business friend. The third man from the secret intelligence area with whom Barbie worked was Ludwig Alves Pacheco. The first name, Ludwig, represents his German ancestry, something which Alves Pacheco boasts about. The Bolivian is also proud of his real German passport. He received the passport, he says, for special services rendered to West Germany. With regard to the quality of Barbie's activities as an agent for the American and West German information agencies, even those Bolivian government members who ought to know it best speak about it only hesitantly. The defense minister of the pro-Western government in Bolivia at the time, Manuel Cardenas Malo, in an official interview, cautiously answered our questions regarding information about Barbie's work for foreign agencies. Cardenas, quote, "We have no documentation about it. They let those disappear," unquote, before President Siles took over the government. But that Barbie worked for foreign intelligence agencies is believable. Many people knew that, and there are many people who can confirm that, unquote. Was Barbie merely an informant, or did he, working for foreign agencies, influence the political development? Cardenas, quote, "Many people who work with Barbie are still in service here. You must understand it is dangerous if they find out that foreigners had so much influence here that they did not just play an advisory role, but that they actually made decisions," unquote. "Do you mean to say that the USA staged the 1980 coup?" Cardenas hesitates, then answers, quote, "Let me say it like this, and then you can quote me. If there isn't a coup happening today, it is only because the Americans are not interested in a coup." So, I misread that last sentence. If there isn't a coup happening today, it is only because of one reason. Because it is the first time that the Americans are not interested in a coup, unquote. So, recapping very briefly, because we have some more information to go into, the fiancés of death, acting at the behest of major cocaine traffickers and in cahoots with the government, acting also with the U.S. government, and Klaus Barbie, the head of this organization, who had previously worked for the U.S. Counterintelligence Corps as well as the Galen Organization, sets up this brutal coup in 1980. After the coup, the government basically takes over the cocaine trade, Garcia Meza and Arce Gomez cornering most of the proceeds with the strong-arm help of Klaus Barbie working for the Central Intelligence Agency, and apparently, according to the people on the inside, the United States heavily involved in setting up the coup that brought them to power. Now, this is an interesting situation, and again, the use of the fiancés of death to eliminate competition for the government-allied cocaine traffickers, very reminiscent of Henry Kruger's scenario in the Great Heroin Coup. And again, bear in mind the triad of U.S. intelligence, international fascism, and the drug trade that's the focus of the broadcast this evening. Now, in the concluding portion, my mouth's getting kind of tired too, in the concluding portion of the broadcast tonight, we're going to take a look at some things sort of bringing some of this information up to date. Although the Contra operation in Nicaragua has gotten the largest amount of publicity, the largest U.S. covert operation is in Afghanistan. The United States is supplying hundreds of millions of dollars every year to the Afghan rebels, and apparently the drug trade, opium and hashish in particular, is heavily involved in the financing of the arms for the Afghan rebels, and a lot of that is winding up in the United States from the so-called Golden Crescent area of Iran, Afghanistan, and Pakistan. And we're going to take a look at the postscript of Henrik Krüger's great heroin coup, where in 1980 he was able to pin down and pinpoint some of the key narcotics trafficking elements for of the Afghan rebels.
All right, reading again from The Great Heroin Coup by Henrik Krüger. "One needn't be an apologist," Mr. Krüger writes, "for Russia's involvement in Afghanistan to see history repeat itself in CIA support for the side financing its operations with opium. By the time the agency admitted supplying arms to Afghanistani insurgent groups, it had long been known that the same groups supported themselves via the drug traffic. As reported a year earlier, quote, feudal landlords whose buildings are threatened with confiscation by the Taraki government are bringing the produce from their poppy crops into Pakistan and use the proceeds to buy rifles, explosives, and other weapons. Pakistani arms merchants report that their new customers come in daily, and business is booming." Guns for drugs, Krüger writes, the same scenario is in Laos, Burma, and Latin America. In a New York Times portrait, Afghanistani rebel leader Syed Ahmed Gailani was described as an aristocrat tied to former King Zahir Shah and the owner of a Peugeot dealership in Kabul. His ancestral holdings confiscated, he was now underwritten by Saudis. Gailani's followers, reports Counterspy magazine, are for the most part Pathan tribesmen, traditional harvesters of opium. Not long after the major dislocations began, tribal areas of Pakistan and Afghanistan were replacing Southeast Asia's Golden Triangle as the major source of heroin in Western Europe, and beginning to ship heroin to the United States. This was reported prior to the Russian invasion by DEA Director Peter Bensinger. Let me read that part again. Not long after the major dislocations began, tribal areas of Pakistan and Afghanistan were replacing Southeast Asia's Golden Triangle as the major source of heroin in Western Europe, and beginning to ship heroin to the United States. This is reported prior to the Russian invasion by DEA Director Peter Bensinger. He added that the Afghanistani police were vigorously combating the narcotics traffic. Afghanistan's 1979 opium harvest was 20 times Mexico's, thanks to their Russian advisors and the decrease in corruption.
Now, the involvement of the Afghan rebels with the narcotics traffic, and bear in mind that they are the recipients of the largest U.S. covert aid now being provided by the intelligence apparatus, that information can be updated from a number of different sources. We're going to take a look at one right now. Reading now from the New York Times of Wednesday, June 18th, 1986. This is an article entitled "Afghan Rebels' Victory Garden, Opium." It's by Arthur Bonner. It's dateline Musakala, Afghanistan. Fields of purple, red, and white poppy flowers, contrasting brilliantly with the dull gray of the surrounding deserts, stretched toward the horizon. In one field, where the petals had fallen to the ground, a line of farmers scraped a brownish-black gum from pale green pods about the size of golf balls. They were harvesting opium that, according to dozens of Afghan rebel commanders and fighters, helps finance their war against troops of the Soviet and Afghan armies. The rebels, encountered here and elsewhere on a 1,000-mile journey through 3 southern Afghan provinces, admitted they are involved in poppy cultivation. The war, the rebels said, created its own economic and moral imperatives. They said the opium harvest was crucial to their survival and their continued efforts to oust the communists. Skipping down on the article. In the shade of an ancient tree to the side of a field where the farmers worked in Musakala, an Islamic teacher explained the importance of opium to the rebels. "How else can we get money?" said the teacher, an elderly man named Mohammed Razul, with a thick gray and black beard and large, watery eyes. His brother, Nazim Akunzada, is regarded by other rebels as the most powerful commander in Helmand province. They said the family has large land holdings that include extensive poppy fields. Quote, "We must grow and sell opium to fight our holy war against the Russian non-believers," Mr. Razul said. Comments like this were heard from dozens of rebels during the journey. Islam does not forbid the harvest, Mr. Razul asserted. Islamic law bans the taking of opium, but there is no prohibition against growing it, he said. The month-long journey with a West German medical team included scenes like this one in poppy fields in every village and town. All the areas were controlled by Afghan rebel commanders and their followers. International anti-narcotics officials in Pakistan say they believe that Afghanistan is the largest single source of illicit opium. American officials estimate that the Afghan crop this year will be 800 metric tons. A State Department report to Congress in February described Afghanistan and the bordering tribal areas of Afghanistan as, quote, the world's leading source of illicit heroin exports to the United States and Europe. Taking that again, a State Department report to Congress in February described Afghanistan and the bordering tribal areas of Pakistan as, quote, the world's leading source of illicit heroin exports to the United States and Europe. Ali Ahmad, a rebel commander in his mid-20s, was interviewed amid the ruins of the town of Sangin, about 60 miles northwest of Kandahar. He and his father are the military rulers of the area, with more than 1,000 Afghan rebels under their control. Their family also has extensive farmland. Green poppy pods danced in a light breeze in a field adjacent to his house as Mr. Ahmad discussed the crop with the eagerness of someone who has recently found a way to repair the fortunes of his family farm. Referring to the rebels' increasing involvement in opium harvesting to finance their war effort, he said, quote, everyone is taking it up, unquote. Again, bearing in mind the scenario that we looked at in Radio Free America number 24, where the Mayo tribesmen, or Hmong tribesmen in Laos, were growing opium. The harvest was then flown into South Vietnam in partnership with the South Vietnamese government by the CIA. It wound up in the arms of our GIs.
Indeed, and the beat goes on. We will read an article from Monday, June 2nd, 1986's San Francisco Chronicle about some rather interesting packages that have been showing up right here in the Bay Area, just to give you the local angle. The article is headlined, Bay Area Getting Afghan Hashish with a Rebel Label. The article is by Paul Liberator. Hashish from Afghanistan is arriving in the Bay Area stamped with a political slogan supporting the Afghan guerrillas in their war against the Soviet Union. One-pound bars of hashish being sold here bear a round gold stamp that says, quote, smoke Russia away. The insignia has a drawing of a semi-automatic rifle in the center and Afghanistan written on the bottom. An agent of the U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration in Washington confirmed that, quote, individual, unquote, rebel fighters are producing and exporting hashish to the United States and other countries, apparently to help finance their war effort. Quote, the best of our knowledge shows that there are individual guerrillas doing it, but not the guerrilla organizations themselves, unquote, he said. The DEA agent said it is difficult to tell the difference between drug dealers and rebels in Afghanistan, and they often may be one and the same. Quote, part of the year they are fighters and part of the year they are farmers, he said. They don't see it, quote, producing and selling drugs, meaning, as doing something wrong. After they sell it, it's someone else's problem. Skipping down in the article. Afghanistan is part of the so-called Golden Crescent that also includes Iran and Pakistan. The region produces more than half of the world's illegal opium. Afghanistan is also a major producer of hashish, a concentrated marijuana product. Afghan rebel leaders say they are opposed to drugs and alcohol because the Quran does not approve of them. They contend that their soldiers do not use drugs themselves because it would violate Islamic teachings and hurt them militarily in their seven-year-old battle against the Russians. Rebel sources admit, however, that heavily armed drug smugglers travel freely over the same trails that they use. Loads of drugs are moved from Afghanistan through Pakistan to Karachi, where they are shipped out with legitimate cargo. Afghan drug dealers do not mind selling to Americans and, quote, they are happy to sell to the Russians, the DEA agent said. There have been reports that Soviet soldiers in Afghanistan use drugs extensively, selling guns, ammunition, and other goods to buy hashish and heroin. The stamp may be mysterious, but there is little doubt that drug smuggling is helping the rebel cause in Afghanistan. Quote, every puff you take is another bit of shrapnel up some Ivan's backside, unquote, one source said. Well, of course, what's entertaining here in a kind of a sick way is the DEA's attempt to maintain that it's the individual rebels that occasionally might happen to, in fact, ship a little bit of drugs here and there back and forth. When, as we've been examining in almost nauseating detail for the past 4 or 5 months, this has been going on forever. As a matter of fact, the United States seems unable to find covert military allies to support who don't seem to be involved in the drug trade, rather than it being a couple of lone wolf drug dealers who just happen to use the same trails as the Mujahideen.
Now, as we mentioned, in May, we're going to be doing 3 4-hour programs, Radio Free America programs, about the Iran-Contra scandal. The team, that an article I'm about to read you, which is referred to as the secret team, is not only heavily involved in cocaine smuggling in order to finance the Contra operation, but has been involved in a big, big way with many of the U.S. intelligence narcotics operations over the years. Reading now from the San Francisco, we're going to go into this, by the way, in much more detail in our 3-part series in May. Reading from the San Francisco Examiner of Monday, December 29th of 1986. This is an article by Vince Bielski, B-I-E-L-S-K-I, headlined, Secret Team Linked with Iran Scandal. Subheaded, Suit Traces North's Unit to CIA Activities in 60s. A secret team, unquote, of former CIA and military officials and arms dealers was involved in the covert weapons shipments to Iran and the Nicaraguan Contra rebels under the direction of fired White House aide Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North, according to an affidavit filed in a Miami lawsuit. Roots of the team date to the secret U.S. war against Cuba in 1961, and its members have since been involved in political assassination programs in Laos, Vietnam, Chile, and now Nicaragua, the affidavit says. The team has also been involved in opium and cocaine trafficking to fund their operations, as the affidavit filed December 15th in a Miami federal court in support of a lawsuit brought by Dan Sheehan, an attorney with the Christic Institute in Washington, D.C. The suit names 29 alleged operatives in the arms network as defendants and alleges that they supplied the explosive used in the May 1984 assassination bid against Contra leader Aden Pastora in Nicaragua, in which 8 people were killed and Pastora was wounded. The plaintiffs, Martha Honey and Tony Avergan, are U.S. journalists who are seeking damages for injuries they suffered in that bombing. The affidavit is based on information from 79 sources, Sheehan says. The defendants who make up the secret team include former high-ranking CIA officials Theodore Shackley and Thomas Kleins, retired Major General Richard Secord, former CIA agent Rafael Quintero, and arms dealer Albert Hakim of Los Gatos. In the affidavit, Sheehan says he learned of the clandestine group from a former U.S. intelligence officer who worked in Iran, a retired CIA officer, and a former Air Force officer. The intelligence officer discussed, quote, the existence of a secret team of former high-ranking American CIA officials, former high-ranking U.S. military officials, and Middle Eastern arms merchants, who also specialized in the performance of covert political assassinations of communists, and which carried on its own independent American foreign policy regardless of the will of Congress, the President, or the CIA, the affidavit says. The source said the team had been set up in the 70s under the supervision of Shackley and Kleins, who were then with the CIA. They joined with Secord and Hakim and went private, unquote, the affidavit says, after leaving the agency in 1982. Before I continue with the article, bear in mind the statement, the information presented in Henry Kruger's The Great Heroin Coup about these, quote, former operatives. Skipping down on the article, Shackley and Kleins worked together at the CIA as early as 1961, after the CIA-backed Bay of Pigs invasion of Cuba, the affidavit says. Shackley, the CIA station chief in Miami, and Kleins, his deputy, directed Operation Mongoose, a covert operation of guerrilla raids into Cuba in 1961 through 3, the affidavit says. Exiles involved in the secret war against Cuba have reportedly resurfaced to play a role in the Contra arms network, including Quintero, Felix Rodriguez, and Luis Posada Carrillo. Rodriguez and Posada allegedly operate from Ilopango Air Base in El Salvador, where arms for the Contras are apparently stored and shipped to the Contras. In 1963, several CIA operatives under Shackley's direction were, quote, caught smuggling narcotics into the U.S. from Cuba, the affidavit reads. 2 years later, the operation was shut down, and Shackley and Kleins were transferred to Laos, where Shackley was made CIA Deputy Chief of Station, and Kleins continued as his deputy, the lawsuit alleges. According to the affidavit, in 1966 through 71, Shackley and Klons directed the Special Operations Group, which trained and used Mayo tribesmen, quote, to secretly assassinate over 100,000 non-combatant village mayors, bookkeepers, clerks, and other civilian bureaucrats in Laos, Cambodia, and Thailand, unquote. That operation was funded by profits from an illegal opium trade run by a Laotian named Vang Pao, this lawsuit alleges. Interrupting, we went into that in great detail in information from Alfred McCoy's The Politics of Heroin in Southeast Asia in Radio Free America number 24. Continuing. In 1966 and 6 through 68, the affidavit says, the commander of the Special Operations Group was now retired Army General John Singlaub, who has said publicly that he is helping arm the Contras, according to the affidavit. One of Singlaub's deputies at the time, the lawsuit says, was then Marine Corps Major Oliver North. Also involved with Shackley and Klons in the assassination program in Laos was Secord, then a deputy air wing commander with the Air Force, the affidavit says. In 1971, Shackley and Klons were transferred to the United States, where Shackley became chief of the CIA's operation in the Western Hemisphere, and Klons continued as his deputy. From their new post, they directed the Track 2 operation in Chile, which played a role in the assassination of Chilean President Salvador Allende and the overthrow of the elected Chilean government in 1973, the affidavit reads. In 1974, the two were transferred to Vietnam, where Shackley joined the CIA station, and Klons was once again his deputy. In 1974 and 75, they directed a project that, quote, carried out the political assassination in Vietnam of some 60,000 village mayors, treasurers, school teachers, and other non-Viet Cong administrators in an attempt to cripple Vietnam's political institutions, the affidavit says. The two funded that operation with POW opium money, according to the affidavit. Because Shackley and Klons, quote, knew that their secret anti-communist extermination program was going to be shut down in Vietnam, Laos, Cambodia, and Thailand in the very near future, they, in 1973, began their own private anti-communist assassination and unconventional warfare program to operate after the end of the Vietnam campaign, the affidavit reads. This was the beginning of the secret team, which 5 years later, in the spring of 1978, would approach Nicaraguan dictator Anastasio Somoza with a plan, quote, the objective of which was to carry out the political assassination of the top leadership of the Sandinista Revolutionary Movement, the affidavit says. By August of 1979, the secret team was supplying the ousted dictator with military weapons for the newly formed Contra forces, the affidavit says. Niptok's now going to read you an article about a specific member of this Contra supply team, who links directly with the Karu Bosch operations that we read about from the Great Heroin Coup.
Indeed. And this article is from the San Jose Mercury News for Thursday, October 16th, 1986. The headline, Contra Figure Linked to Jet Bombing. It's by Tim Golden, Knight Ridder News Service. Dateline Managua. Sandinista security officials said Wednesday that a Cuban exile... Sandinista security officials said Wednesday that a Cuban exile who allegedly helped run an El Salvador-based Contra supply operation is an escapee from a Venezuelan jail where he was being held for the 1976 bombing of a Cuban jetliner. Deputy Interior Minister Luis Carrion said Sandinista officials are convinced that Ramon Medina, identified by a captured U.S. pilot as the number two figure in the Contra supply operation, is in fact Luis Posada Carriles, one of four suspects, including Orlando Bosch, charged in the Cubana airliner bombing that claimed 73 lives. Posada Carriles escaped from prison last year. Carrion said at a news conference Wednesday in Managua that Eugene Hassenfuss, the American captured 2 weeks ago, had identified Posada from photographs shown him by interrogators. He also cited other unidentified Sandinista intelligence sources he said indicated that Medina and Posada were the same person. Quote, we are certain that it's him, Carrion said. Skipping down in the article. Posada Carriles was arrested in Venezuela a few weeks after a bomb exploded in the Cubana Airlines DC-8 shortly after it took off from Barbados on October 6, 1976, heading for Havana. A naturalized Venezuelan, Posada had worked for Venezuelan military intelligence. Venezuelan authorities accused Posada and Bosch a Cuban exile whose case had become a cause célèbre in some exile circles, as, quote, the intellectual authors of the bombing. Posada Carriles escaped August 18, 1985, from a national penitentiary in San Juan de los Morros, 60 miles southwest of Caracas, Venezuela. Venezuela's justice minister told reporters after the escape that Posada had bribed a prison guard supervisor. Venezuelan press accounts put the payoff as high as $25,000, a sum financed, according to unconfirmed Venezuelan reports, by an anti-Castro group. Posada's presence in Central America had been announced over Miami radio stations late last year. Tomás Regalado, general news editor at WQBA radio station, said Posada's associates distributed a taped message from Posada to WQBA and other Spanish-language stations in which he said he had escaped from jail because he expected no justice in Venezuela. Posada also said he was, quote, fighting communism in Central America. Again, as Dave pointed out, a direct connection between the Contras and the Orlando Bosch operation, Carew, the JM Wave Station of Miami, etc. Further proof, if any was really needed at this point, that basically the whole Contra operation is merely an outcropping of the Bay of Pigs operation. It's just Bay of Pigs Part 6 or something like that, whatever the number would be by now.
And the heavy involvement, as indicated in the article I read before, the one Nip just read, of this same team, Theodore Shacklich, the head of JM Wave, where he came directly from Berlin, and this whole team involved, which obviously weaves in a very direct way throughout the entire Radio Free America series we've been doing, and of course, the heavy intersections between this team and the Triple Wilson team. We're going to be going into that and other things in the three-part series in May. One of the U.S. intelligence operations heavily involved in the narcotics and arms traffic that we detailed in Radio Free America number 25 was the Nguyen Bank. An article linking the secret team involved in the Iran-Contra scandal with the Nguyen Bank appeared in the San Francisco Chronicle of Monday, March 9, 1987. This is a Chronicle Wire Service story entitled, Aussie Connection to North Probed. Several former military and intelligence officers who helped Marine Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North ship weapons to Iran and Central America were closely associated with the co-founder of an Australian financial concern that collapsed in 1980. Among those linked to the failed Sydney-based concern, Nguyen Bank, and its co-founder, Michael J. Hand, was Richard Secord, a retired Air Force Major General who helped North conduct airlifts of weapons to the Middle East and Central America, according to the four-year-old Australian investigation. The Australian study, parts of which are still secret, was completed in 1983 by the Commonwealth New South Wales Joint Task Force on Drug Trafficking. The study is receiving scrutiny again in Washington because of the details it contains about activities and movement of weapons around the world by many of the figures involved in the Iran-Contra affair. The Australian report also concluded that several former CIA officials and contract operatives, among them Theodore G. Shackley, Thomas G. Kleins, and Rafael Quintero, were involved in military and intelligence-related activities with Hand and other top officers of the Nguyen concern. The Tower Commission report on the Iran-Contra affair and other published reports have linked all of these men to operations in the Middle East and Central America directed by North, the National Security Council aide dismissed in November by President Reagan. Secord and the other men in the network are the focus of an investigation by the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. The Australian study, a congressional aide said, provides additional evidence that will help the committee determine whether this group simultaneously functioned over the years as official government intelligence agents while also conducting illegal and illegal operations for profit. The Australian study does not demonstrate that Secord, Shackley, Kleins, or Quintero smuggled weapons or narcotics. It does say, however, that these men were close to Hand, a former Army Green Beret and military intelligence officer who served in Laos during the late 1960s with a CIA-owned airline named Air America. Well, if the Australian study doesn't name it, just about everything else that we've dealt with in this series does. The point being, again, that the team involved in the Iran-Contra scandal goes clear back to the entire milieu of the U.S. National Security Establishment's heavy, heavy involvement with drug smuggling that we have detailed in this and the other three previous Radio Free America programs about the CIA and the National Security Establishment's drug trafficking operations. The next broadcast, Radio Free America number 28, we'll deal with the LSD trade, the psychedelic subculture of the 1960s, and the heavy, massive involvement of our national security establishment in bringing that about. And we will document that next month. Then we're going to be, in a sense, extending this discussion in May with 3 4-hour programs about Iran-Contragate.
And with that, yes, with that, we're going to wrap it up. But what we are going to do very quickly before we go is we're going to give you a couple of bits of information. First off, sources on a lot of the books. Again, we mentioned we read extensively from The Great Heroin Coup. If you cannot find that in your local used bookstore or in your library, you might contact Tom Davis Books, a service that we mention quite frequently because Tom Davis has an extensive selection of these types of books. And if we ever found another service that that had what Tom Davis has, we would tout them too. There's no connection between Tom Davis's company and ourselves, except that we found a lot of useful books there. You can get a hold of a catalog if you write to Tom Davis Books at P.O. Box 1107, Aptos, California, 95001-1107. I'll give that one more time. Tom Davis Books, P.O. Box 1107, Aptos, California, 95001-1107. Okay, and as mentioned, nobody here gets anything out of this one. So that's you're on your own, but he is an excellent source for these kinds of books.
Now, if you cannot locate a source of the Great Heroin Coup, if for some reason Tom Davis is sold out, or if you can't find it about, because it is in other places, libraries, of course, is a very good place to check. The Radio Free America shows, all 26 to date, plus number 27, which will be going down there this week, are available from a tape duplication service, as are our Guns of November shows and a lot of different One Step Beyond shows on permanent file down at this tape service. The name of this tape duplication service is DAVKORE, DAVKORE. They're located at Suite 1300D, as in DAVKORE, Space Parkway, three words just like it sounds. That's in Mountain View, California, zip code 94043. The phone number is area code 415-969-3030. Write or phone to the attention of Paul. Once again, DAVKORE, DAVKORE, located at Suite 1300D, Space Parkway, Mountain View, California, 94043. Phone number, area code 415-969-3030. Write or phone to the attention of Paul. And again, neither Nip nor myself nor the station makes any money off of this. We have no financial connection with the organization. In fact, I just got done paying a very large bill this past week for some copies they made for me. So.
All right. And with that, we are going to prepare to roll on out the door. We're going to play a song for you that you might find entertaining as we go. We do want to mention that unlike tonight, which was an odd Sunday night for us since it was a Radio Free America, next Sunday will be the usual One Step Beyond show from 8 to 11 o'clock. And probably with time for phone calls and all of those things that make One Step Beyond shows different from Radio Free America shows. I don't know if they make them easier, but they make them different. So don't go away and stick around. There will be music on till 2 o'clock, but first we're going to play a little song that came from an open mic show here up at the radio station, and then we're going to bid you goodnight. So for Dave Emery and myself, Nip Tuck, thank you for joining us. And thank you for listening to Radio Free America here on KFJC.
This song got us thrown out of the Keystone chain. And I don't know why. We're playing with Jim Carroll, and he can talk about all his friends that died. But I can't talk about this subject. It's near and dear to my heart because of Jerry. Well, I'm a Coke Nazi, goose-stepping down my plate. Well, I'm a Coke Nazi. My nose is plastic, so's my brain. I've lost 50 pounds, and that's no lie. I'm doing 3 grams a day, or as much as I can buy. I owe everybody money, but I can always hide, 'cause I'm a Coke Nazi. Can you relate? Look at all those people staring at each other out there. I'm a Coke Nazi. Fill my plate. Well, I'm a Coke Nazi.
I always whack it for my friend.
Yeah, I does.
Yeah, yeah. No, sure. Well, I'm a Coke Nazi. I cheat my mother when I can. When I weigh it, it's always short. And when I wrap it, I always take a snort, 'cause I'm a Coke Nazi. Can you relate? Yeah. I'm a Coke Nazi. Fill my plate. Well, I'm a Coke Nazi. No time to sing, I need a line. Got one, Jer?
Yeah.
Good boy. Well, I'm a Coke Nazi. I chop all day to make it fine. All right, the finale. I lick the razor. I lick the plate. I like my teeth numb every hour. I'm a waiter. Sing how Coke Nazi. Can you relate? Oh, look at them laughing at each other. Sing ho!
Sing ho!
Coke Nazi! Fill my plate. Sing ho! Coke Nazi! Can you relate? Thank you very much. Jerry and Vice, heart attack.
Radio Free. America.